The Guardian.
Around 3.5 billion years ago, long before human civilization, before the dinosaurs, and even before the first plants began to sprout, life on Earth comprised two microbial kingdoms, bacteria and archaea. Today we call these two groups the prokaryotes.
They had the planet for themselves for quite a while, for let's say 1.5 billion years.
Then, one day, something happened.
2 billion years ago, give or take 500 million years, I would say, this new group of life emerged, and that's when the eukaryotes came into play.
What happened to cause this new life form to emerge, and exactly how it happened, is still something of a mystery. But we do know that this event gave rise to all complex life on Earth today, including us. Recently, scientists came a step closer to piecing together this puzzle, thanks to a decade-long quest by a Japanese team.
In deep sea mud, there's a group of archaea that is extremely different from any other known archaea or any other known microorganisms that we had almost no information about at the time, except its existence.
This week, we'll be journeying back to when the Earth was scorchingly hot, a time when there was still only one landmass, Pangaea, and what little atmosphere existed was lacking any oxygen whatsoever. All in search of one question: how did complex life on Earth begin?
How life exactly begun is still very much debated. The only thing what we can say now is that there is essentially two primordial life forms that we consider to be prokaryotes. And these are the bacteria on the one hand and the archaea on the other hand.
That's Thijs Etema, a professor of microbiology at the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands. I started by asking Thijs about what separates the prokaryotes from eukaryotes, the cells that make up everything from plants to insects to animals.
The textbook difference between cells of prokaryotes, and that would be the bacteria and the archaea, and the cells of eukaryotes, really lie into the cellular complexity. And with that I mean that cells of eukaryotes are filled with all sorts of little compartments, complex endomembrane systems that are typically lacking in cells of prokaryotes. On top of that, the cells of eukaryotes typically are, at least I would say, an order of magnitude bigger than the cells of prokaryotes. But also, eukaryotes come in many shapes and many flavors. And for instance, the eukaryotes also evolved multicellularity. And of course, we humans are a direct result of that invention. So suddenly, there were a whole lot of new opportunities, a lot of new niches that could be conquered by these eukaryotes. And this gave rise to a whole new diversity of different types of life that we see around us still today.
Over the years since, it's been discovered that there are these different cell types and that our cells look very different from an E. coli cell, for example. Have there been lots of different theories for how we got from one to the other?
Well, yes. As soon as this was discovered, and this is a long time ago, that eukaryotic cells were fundamentally different compared to those of bacteria. I mean, archaea were actually only relatively recently discovered. There were already numerous theories that popped up to explain how this might have happened. Over a century ago, there were the first indications that certain structures inside these bigger, more complex cells could have been derived from bacteria, in fact. So the idea was, at the time, that these were actually organisms living inside other organisms. Later on, these observations were sort of bundled by people like Lynn Margulis, who proposed that these organelles inside these eukaryotic cells were the result of an endosymbiosis, so that these organelles were once free-living bacteria, but then somehow they got taken up by this eukaryotic cell, and that's how these organelles came into existence.
You've mentioned that people only really found out about archaea quite recently. Why have they been neglected, and why weren't they obvious in our environment?
Well, people have in fact been studying archaea already for quite a long time. They just never really realized that they were a very separate or very different type of organisms as compared to bacteria. And the main reason for that is that if you would look under a microscope, you would not be able to distinguish archaea from bacteria. And it is only since the revolution of molecular biology that we were able to distinguish those two life forms based on their genetic material. And this has really been pioneered by Carl Woese in the 1970s with his methodology that was very revolutionary at the time. He managed to identify this completely new domain of life that he initially called the archaebacteria. But later, in order to make this distinction more clear, we renamed these into the archaea. So the archaea are a separate primordial domain of life.
Is there a reason why people may not be familiar with them? Is it just because they don't cause diseases, so people aren't as aware of them in our environment? Or is it because archaea are more rare on Earth these days than bacteria?
Well, they were discovered much later, so maybe archaea haven't really penetrated that much into the general knowledge, so in the textbooks, etc. Another contributing factor that you also mentioned is that archaea are harmless organisms. They don't cause any diseases. And because of that, I think they've also gotten less attention. Initially, when archaea were discovered, they were essentially first found in various extreme environments. And in that sense, they were also portrayed as being extreme bacteria as such. But nowadays, it's much clearer that archaea are essentially, you can find them everywhere, including in your backyard, essentially. So they are not extreme organisms. They are everywhere and they are as abundant as bacteria, at least in the same order of magnitude.
Despite their abundance, archaea are still a somewhat mysterious life form. And debate is ongoing about exactly how they might have played host and gobbled up a bacterium to form the first eukaryote. So in the early 2000s, researchers began the search for potential archaeal candidates.
Our goal is to hunt and collect new organisms, new microorganisms, all around Earth. My name is Masaru Nobu. I'm a US citizen working in Japan in a research institute, National Institute of Advanced and Industrial Science and Technology. And our focus for a long time has been focusing on the deep sea organisms.
Deep sea mud is a good place to go archaea hunting, as its lack of oxygen and often extreme conditions, like high temperatures and toxicity, mean there are fewer bacterial species to sift through. There was also a particular type of archaea that Masaru and his colleague Hiro Imachi were keen to get their hands on.
The reason that we targeted this group of archaea was that even before we started the sampling, we knew that in deep sea mud, there is a group of archaea that is extremely different from any other known archaea or any other known microorganisms that we had almost no information about at the time, except its existence. And we wanted to know what it was doing, what it looked like, what it could tell us about life.
With a sediment sample from a trough 2.5 kilometers below the surface of the ocean, Masaru and Hiro started trying to turn this column of thick black mud into something they could cultivate in the lab. First by mixing it into household sponges and putting them into a bioreactor. I asked Masaru how they went from that to having an archaea to analyze.
So these organisms, we expected them to grow very slowly because in the deep sea, there isn't much energy going in, there isn't much food available, and it's very, very cold. So the organisms there, we expected that they would be growing very slowly, so we were very patient. Once we put the mud into the reactor with the sponges and started dripping synthetic seawater down, we waited, and about once a year or so, we would open the reactor to see how it's going, what kind of organisms were there. And every time we were very pleasantly surprised to see that the organisms there were actually organisms that were alive in the original sample. Usually when we bring organisms or a group of organisms back from the natural environment to the lab, we end up getting a mix of organisms that aren't actually all that active in the original habitat. So it seemed like even from the first year that things were working out.
But can I just jump in there and say, you know, most people are used to getting some kind of feedback on maybe every day or every week or month at work. but you sound quite calm about the fact that you had to open this thing up after a year. And okay, you were pleasantly surprised, but there must have been an element of anxiety in the lead up to each yearly opening of this reactor.
Yes, the only tool we had was hope for a long time. So in order to, as we opened it every year to try and see if the RQ was still there, we used methods like a PCR, polymerase chain reaction, to confirm that they're still there and still alive.
So you opened it up every year. How long did this go on for before you kind of moved the samples or kind of moved things along to the next step?
So as we opened it every year, we tried every time to grow these archaea. And although we knew the archaea were still alive in the reactor, for the first few years, we were very discouraged in that we couldn't get them to grow in test tubes after we took the mud out of the reactor. And we weren't sure what was going on, because when we designed how to grow these organisms in test tubes, we used a very strategic approach. We had a guess that these organisms might grow on protein, amino acids, and also we added antibiotics. A lot of our antibiotics that we use target bacteria. They don't work very well in archaea. So we were confused. Why isn't this working? We were pretty confident that it should work. And years down the line, Hiro had the idea, maybe they're just growing really slowly. Usually when we try to judge whether we've successfully captured an organism in a test tube, we can see the liquid get very murky and very turbid because we get a lot of cells of the organisms. And we weren't getting that. So what we did is, instead of just using sort of that kind of qualitative approach, we used a very, very precise approach to really pin down how many cells of these archaea are in these bottles when we start, after a month, after 2 months, after 3 months. And what we found out was the archaea all along, although we had thought we failed every time, this archaea was actually growing in these tubes. It just wasn't growing as much as we expected.
So when you had this breakthrough and you realized it was growing, it was just growing very slowly, was that the point where you were able to look at what these cells actually looked like? Or did you have further work to do?
When we realized it was growing, it wasn't still pure yet. So we had many, many other organisms inside of the culture. And scientists studying animals, we can see the animal, we can see what they're eating, we can see what they're doing. But with microorganisms, we can't really see what they're doing actively. What they're eating, what they're producing, it's all chemicals that we can't see at all, even with a microscope. So we really need to capture this organism, purify it in order to see what it's doing, see what it looks like. So it took us quite a bit of time after that to track this organism down, really capture it. Another long process.
And so how many years did you put in at that point to pinning this thing down?
From the beginning, from the reactor, that was 12 years.
Were there any points where you just felt, I'm just sick of this thing. Why did I start working on it? I just want to, you know, bin all these test tubes full of sponges and do something easier.
Thankfully, all of us and the collaborators were very patient people.
That's it for part one. After the break, we'll be rejoining Masaru's 12-year odyssey to cultivate the Asgard archaea and hearing about the fortuitous discovery made while their experiment was running.
Today in Focus is the daily news podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, every weekday as I bring you stories from across the UK and around the world. We'll take you to the front line of the climate emergency.
The smoke smells like everything is on fire.
Behind the scenes in Westminster.
We're in the sort of political Wild West.
And we'll cover the latest trends in technology and popular culture.
TikTok, TikTok, buzz, buzz, buzz.
Go on, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. When Masaru Nobu's epic journey to cultivate the Asgard archaea began, hardly anything was known about it, except that it existed, and it was very different from anything else out there. Then, during the course of his work, across the globe, another interesting discovery was made about the same species that he was attempting to isolate.
In 2015, I think, the group of scientists used genomics to track down these archaea and managed to recover fragments of their genome and get really interesting insight into what they may be capable of, what they may be doing. And they found out that these archaea might be very closely related to the ancestor of us eukaryotes. And that was an amazing insight that would have a very profound impact on both microbiology and evolution, how we see ourselves, humans or eukaryotes.
I started working on archaea already quite a long time ago, during my PhD.
That's Thijs, who you heard from in part one.
At the time, I wasn't really that much interested in evolution, but this all changed when I started doing a postdoc. And I really got intrigued by this question about how the eukaryotic cell could have evolved.
With the evidence for the origin of eukaryotic cells pointing towards the kingdom of archaea, Thijs got his hands on samples from deep marine sediments from near a hydrothermal vent called Loki's Castle, and started to analyse them with a technique known as metagenomics.
Of all the microbes that are present on our planet, less than 1% we can currently grow in our lab, meaning that 99% of all the microbes out there, we cannot study them with traditional methods. So the only way we can study them is by looking at their DNA. But you have to imagine that in any given environment, and that includes also the marine sediments, there is hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of different species of microbes there. How we can study these organisms at the genomic level is that we get all the DNA out of these sediments, and these are all tiny bits and pieces. We sort of try to piece that together, and by doing that, we also try to reconstruct the genome sequences of the organisms that were present in these marine sediments. And lo and behold, so this first sample where we started using this metagenomics approach, we obtained several DNA fragments. There were genes on these pieces of DNA that were typically archaeal, but they also contained genes that were typically eukaryotic. And these were not just any genes. No, these were genes that in eukaryotes carry out various functions that are characteristic for eukaryotic cellular complexity. That was really a groundbreaking finding at the time.
After Thijs uncovered what he named the Loki archaeota, after the Norse shape-shifting god, other teams around the world found related species, and collectively the group became known as the Asgard archaea. Yet despite these discoveries, Thijs had no idea what an Asgard archaea cell might look like. Now, after waiting several years, and thanks to Masaru's incredible efforts, he's finally been able to see one.
It was just so different from what everybody, I guess, would have expected. It was just like an organism from another planet. I mean, I was immediately struck, of course. I mean, this is exciting to read this report, and especially at what lengths they had gone to obtain this organism in culture. It was really fantastic to read, and it was already clear from the start that this was going to be a really important contribution. First of all, the organisms that we had proposed, the Loki and other Asgard organisms, that they exist, first of all, because there were some people in the community that were even skeptic about that. Then I think several people were quite skeptic about if it even would be possible to culture these organisms, and it would be very time-consuming and slow organisms, and nobody had any idea about how this could best be done, because these organisms might also rely on other microorganisms, which makes cultivation even more difficult. And this was also essentially confirmed by the Japanese group. They could only grow this Loki organism in co-culture with another bacteria or another archaeal lineage, but they showed that it can be done. They also essentially have been using a lot of traditional methods to culture this lineage, And, well, potentially with other new modern methods, it could even be done faster. So I'm very positive about the future and about all the future efforts that will be done to culture new Asgard organisms.
So what did the Asgard archaea actually look like? Unsurprisingly, it took a while to reveal itself, even to Masaru.
Actually, around 2013-14, by the time we realized that these organisms were actually growing, and what we were looking at were very, very tiny spheres. And in the beginning, we were thinking, well, this is kind of what it's a classic archaeon would look like, just a small sphere. But one day we took a sample from a bottle that we had left a little too long. Usually we leave them for about 2-3 months and then transfer them to the next bottle to keep growing them. At one point we had an old bottle and said, well, we don't have any other samples to look at, so let's look at this one. And what we found was that these small spheres disappeared. We didn't see any small spheres. And in the beginning, Hiro thought we lost the culture, which would have been devastating. But actually, as we looked at the photos of the cells that were in this culture, we realized we do see the spheres. It's just, instead of just being spheres, there's super long tentacle-like structures branching out of these spheres.
And so what do you think might have happened? I mean, I know that we're still talking about something that is billions of years separated from your organism in terms of evolution. But assuming it looked something similar, like a blob with these tentacly arms and it's got its companion, possibly a companion bacteria that's living alongside, how does that take us forward in trying to understand how life on Earth made this momentous leap from microbes and archaea to complexity?
Based on what we found out about this archaea, we believe that this organism was always dependent on a partner for building its own cell and always dependent on other partners for adapting to new environments. At some point, this archaea and bacterium were interacting very closely, intimately. And we believe that these tentacle-like structures, these combined together to for the archaea to take the bacterium inside of its own cell. From there, it's a bit of a complicated process, but we believe that there is a lot of symbiosis going on between the archaea and bacterium inside of its cell. We proposed certain features that needed certain problems, certain issues that needed to be hashed out for this archaea and bacterium to really live together harmoniously and evolve into the first eukaryote, where we have a host archaea and a bacterium inside that's breathing oxygen and providing energy.
By finally getting a glimpse of an Asgard archaea, with its spaghetti-like tendrils handy for reaching out and engulfing one of its bacterial partners, Masaru and Tice's work has given us another vital piece of the puzzle of how a primitive eukaryote could have been formed. This scenario is still speculative, not least because the cells that exist today could be very different from those that existed billions of years ago when that crucial evolutionary leap was taken. But it is likely to reignite the debate and trigger more research into one of our most fundamental questions. How did complex life begin on Earth? That's it for this week. Many thanks to Masaru Nobu and Tice Etima. We'll include a link to the article on Asgard archaea and Masaru's paper at theguardian.com. If you have any thoughts or feedback, feel free to send us an email, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. This episode was presented by me, Hannah Devlin, and produced by Madeline Finley.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.